gringo, what's that song you're playing?
It's Mariachi Mexico, otherwise known as Spaghetti West Auckland, by the Pagliacci's. Far away to a little home, and I want to come with E and ESS. And your ESSAY, and your ESS, and your ESSAY.
Mariachi Mexico. Mariachi.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another exciting edition of the Darker, Colder Mysticism Show. And we are recording this particular episode with Freda X and James Wright, and we also have a tag along in the in the call here, Mr. Colston, who's a good old friend of Freda's, but he'll probably be muted in the background. So, without further ado, I'm going to actually have to preface this show, because we were having a conversation previously before it, and it concerns people wanting to bow down and fulfill the majesty and the promise of power and corruption and scumbaggery, to such a point where they actually think that the Illuminati are the good guys and want to serve them. This sort of thing. It was a conversation I had last night. It kind of like freaked me out a little bit that I could hear somebody talking about this kind of scumbaggery in a positive light. Like somebody who knows what they've done and what they do and what their stated intentions are. It doesn't seem to wash anymore for some reason. I wonder what kind of caused that mentality. So today, ladies and gentlemen, on the Dark Occult of Mysticism show, we have my very special guest, James Wright, and my very special co-host, Freda X. So, Freda, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Vinny, and hey, how's it going, Jay?
Good, thank you.
So, in your experiences and your fields into the occult and mystics and having really first-hand experience as to what these people act like, what they really feel, and indeed access to primary literature that many would never have read or seen had they not been a member of so many orders and what have you. Do you guys have any special kind of perspective on what would actually attract somebody into the mindset of the Illuminati?
Yeah, it's powerlessness. You know, a state of feeling hopeless or helpless and powerless to meet the obstacles, the oppositions of modern day. You know, I mean, I think it's very clear that in these times, in postmodern times, we have people who just feel like they lack the vital power to make the essential changes that are needed. And, you know, I mean, why do you think people are so interested in mafia? You know, there's so much interest in America and mafioso one of the reasons is because of the attraction of the power that such a membership in those organizations would bring. And that's, I think, what draws people into orders like Freemasonry and other esoteric orders, too, is the idea that you belong to an organization that's worldwide, that has millions of members, that are pledged to take care of each other, to keep each other's secrets, to watch each other's back, to fly to each other's relief, even if only in lip service. At least it is. That's the you know, the what's being presented. In Mafia, you're a member of the family. They take care of you. You know, that's what they imply. But as we know from so many stories, it doesn't always work out that way, especially when people are not, you know, when they're dishonorable, when they lack the virtue and morals. But you know, I always found that fascinating. Anyways, mafioso, they go to church and stuff, and they're all like, you know, going to each other's godchildren baptism and stuff, and then they go and kill people. And they say a novena and do a little crucifix, and everything's okay, right? You know, I always thought that was a little strange. But anyways, yeah. So I think it's personally, it's easy to understand, and also is if people lack, they lose the amoralistic, nihilistic view that rises out of this postmodern time where everything, you know, there's no meaning, you know, everything's explained away and rationalized and oversimplified. But what would you say, Jay?
I think that power itself is a very potent opiate, and the acquisition thereof is something that seems to be at the forefront of a lot of people's minds, especially right now in a society where people, I think, are suffering from feeling less and less like they're in control. So you have individuals out there, and I see it all the time, like we were talking about before air, you know, that pretty much go online and put open pleas to the so-called Illuminati. Oh, please recruit me. Please, please, I'll do anything. You know, and that's pretty scary.
Well,
that they're willing.
Continue.
Well, I mean, in the context that so much of what's come out has, and there seems to be this definite discontent among the planet right now toward secret societies and everything growing, which, you know, throughout history it's kind of been like a pendulum with that, but we're definitely on that other side now. And the fact that in an information age, with so much good information out there, which I know it's a arduous task sifting through the good versus the bad. However, once you do get good information on your side, to sit there and consciously still make a decision like that, that you would want or desire to be a part of something corrupt or criminal or whatever the word, it just goes to show that we're in a pretty bad state as a world. And I don't think it's, oh, point the finger at the New World Order and all that. You know, it begins on the street level with people. So either they want change or don't. And if there's a growing group out there who seems to lust after some sort of esoteric, mafioso-dominated society, then, well, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I think that is indeed a very good point. The point being is society at the moment, I believe, is in a state of free fall collapse, and it's not just free falling economically. It's also doing so in the health of the people, and it's also doing so in the minds of the people. So IQs have dropped sharply. As we all know, you take a test that was given to a 7-year-old or something like that way back in the day, a couple of hundred years ago. Even educated PhD adults today would fail those tests. Such is the method that we've slipped, right? And I've kind of concluded that this is not an accident. Whenever you have a tyrannical dictator, whether they be a group or an individual, they often seek to dumb down the population, to restrict their access to food, nutrition, nutrients, things of that nature, which would help their brains develop. And in so doing, those people are so deliberately dumbed down that they're simply incapable of even realizing that there is a direct agenda. And conversely, there are people who have woken up to this agenda who don't realize how dumbed down they still are. And they don't realize that you can be pushed, even if you think it's you're doing the truth and the right thing, right into their hands. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally get it. I think you're right on there. I mean, and this is par for the course of this postmodern, you know, condition. And it's not surprising that you'd hear people inviting it, or, I mean, who isn't tempted? Who doesn't want to have bonus status? Who doesn't want to get preferred treatment? Who doesn't want to come into a place and feel like they're, you know, they're going to get the best service that there is? You know, I mean, isn't that enticing to everyone? Isn't that inviting? It's just a question of what it costs. What's the cost for that? You know, I mean,
my perspective on this is different. I mean, I look at a millionaire who's got $1 million in the bank, but only two or three people really in his life will do anything for him. I want to, my form of wealth that I want to have is two or three bucks in the bank, but 1 million people will do anything for me.
Well, it's strange. You know, go ahead, Jay.
It staggers me about, like, just recently the political campaigns. I mean, how anyone in their right mind can donate money if, like the analogy you made, if you have $1 million. If you have $1 million and you're donating $30,000 to Mitt Romney, I mean, don't you think you should maybe take a time out there and rethink the way you're spending that money? I'm sure there's a 100,000 better causes that $30,000 could go to than Mitt freaking Romney, you know? That's
yeah. If they really wanted to impress people with a real presidential campaign, right? Take this. I heard something like $6 billion has been raised for the campaign. So give each of those candidates $3 billion each and tell them to go solve some problems in America. Whoever does the best with the money, that's the guy who ends up being president. I mean, that would be an actual effective campaign. But yeah, we're dealing with a reality where it's disgusting. It's disgusting that they would spend that kind of money on advertising. And well, basically, they spend a lot of that money paying people off to get their votes. They literally buy votes with that money, too. It's not just, you know, advertising.
Well, apparently, bribing politicians is one of the most profitable endeavors that mankind has ever actually concocted. Because if you have a $1 billion interest, and you give $1 million, which is 1/1,000th of your wealth, to bribe a politician, he can in turn create legislation out of obligation to you to make you $2 billion.
Yeah, that's absolutely the name of the game. You're absolutely right. But I wanted to come back around to what we were saying about your perception of wealth and the wealthy. You know, the idea of a millionaire and what his options are. I am in a unique position, being raised in an area that's like a resort area that attracts a lot of wealth, that first started bringing wealth around here back in the 20s, before the Depression hit, you know, when the boom of America back then, they built these giant resort hotels right on the shore. And a lot of wealthy people bought up land around those hotels and, you know, built big houses. And we come to the present day. But what it's been is an experience for me growing up with my family having companies that are basically they're caretakers for the estates of these wealthy people. And it's a good life in an area around here. You get paid really well to be a caretaker for these wealthy people, let me tell you. But having that experience, I've been raised around wealthy people growing up. And, you know, one of the things I've always found fascinating about people who are worth like hundreds of millions of dollars is how inept they seem, how seemingly incompetent they are with everyday life. I mean, they require a team of specialists to, you know, navigate their way through their everyday life. I remember watching a man who, basically, his family owned USA Today newspaper, you know, which was like a worldwide newspaper back in the day. It's suffered now, but back in the day, it was huge. This guy couldn't assemble a basic barbecue, you know, like a grill that you'd put in your backyard to do some do some cooking with, you know, to do some grilling with. He could not put these aluminum legs on this barbecue, man, for the life of him. And I'm watching him. It's like watching a monkey trying to hump a football. You know what I mean?
That is a nice image. He's the $100 million monkey football humping man.
You know what I mean? And that's the kind of, that's a, just a little, just a little taste of what I'm talking about. A little picture of the kind of experiences you get. And you start to, like, it really, I think, creates a certain bitterness, a certain cynicism when you realize
Well, hold on. But there's two types of wealthy people. Those who were born to it and those who created it.
Okay, you got me there, but you know, the funny thing is that those who create it only usually last one or two generations at tops.
Well, that's true, and James, you have a story about this. You indeed come from a family that was practically ridiculed because way back in the day you had some kind of an ancestor who made it big, but since then everybody's been kind of just going downhill until just recently with yourself and I think it was your uncle who was murdered as well. You kind of broke free of this sort of family curse.
Yes, miraculously I did, and I thank God every day for it. It seems like for the past two, because I come from very, very old money, and the past two generations have just, you know, been the types to spend their millions unwisely, and we've been plagued with drug problems and other troubles with the law amongst my cousins and everything. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's just something that I can't associate with or participate in, especially after my aunt came to me while I was in pre-publication with New Falcon over the book and told me to burn it and not publish it because she said it would embarrass the family and blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, well, this family suffered so many embarrassments over its time, I doubt I could ever attempt to pull off anything like my dear sweet cousins have. So, you know, we sort of agreed to disagree on that, and it's just sort of a non-issue now. We don't discuss it, and she's definitely not happy about it. She was a daddy's girl. Daddy was a 33rd. The mentality she grew up going as a child to the Scottish Rite, you know, to watch him and various degree vignettes and everything put on for the public. And so she has a great deal of admiration for that. And she also has Alzheimer's. So I can understand how she can remember that stuff, but not necessarily what happened once it became my turn. And so, you know, it's just a sad situation all around. And then in January, after we found out my cousin was murdered, that was pretty much it for me, because he and I were the only two to ever move away. And now, strangely enough, I'm living about 30 minutes from where he did. So I've kind of been coping with that finally. And, you know, life goes on. And, you can either rise above it and break the cycle or just fall right into it. And the thought of falling into that sickness in my family is just, I'd rather be dead, you know.
Now, there are some who would say that you took individual responsibility for your own life and your own actions, and you carved a better path for yourself. Therefore, anybody who doesn't do that exact thing, carve a path for themselves, should be exterminated because they're useless.
Well, my spiritual attitude is, you know, we all incarnated here on this planet at this time. We all have something to do to help the world revolve on its axis, you know, whether that's cleaning floors somewhere or writing legislation or whatever. We all do our part. No one is more important than the next person. So,
well, even the largest wheels in the machine can stop moving if only the smallest wheel in the machine stops.
Yes. Absolutely,
you know, it's all connected, and it all keeps going round, and I've got this idea, right, is that in order to build a better machine, you simply need more wheels, more cogs, more of this, that, and the other, so you create a bigger machine. But the problem is with that, it means that a single cog in that machine can stop working, and it throws the whole thing out of whack. And I was just thinking about this. It's the idea of individuality versus collectivism. the idea of centralization of control and decision making and power and wealth versus the distribution of it. The concept I'm trying to work on here is, at what point do you stop saying it's my responsibility to help other people, and now it is their responsibility to help themselves? I mean, have you ever met somebody and you tried to help them, but they just wouldn't help themselves, and you go, okay, man, you're on your own?
Yes, you can't help those who won't help themselves, yeah.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, it's very frustrating, but, you know, I think the problem is that we're stuck in that quantum entanglement approach where, you know, like Einstein says, you can't solve the problems of consciousness with the same consciousness. You have to somehow change, expand, transcend this consciousness. So, you know, taking a leap from that premise, we are dealing with a system that was flawed from the beginning because it was always stacked in favor of the few at the expense of the many. It's always been about extracting the production wealth from the general public in order to feed the true most dependent and entitled class of society, which is in fact the wealthy class. Those are the real welfare state. The people who do the least amount of work, the most unproductive members of society, are usually the wealthiest members of society. People who do all the work are the working class folks that I know every day that work 2-3 jobs just to get the bills paid and put their kids through school and have something to look forward to at the end of the trail, you know?
You're absolutely right. And what I would add to that is, you know, the human spirit is an amazing thing. Like with Hurricane Sandy, they were showing shots on CNN and the other news networks, you know, of little children going out on the beach that live there and just picking up debris, you know? Kind of like when the day of 27 tornadoes in Dallas, people that had never met their neighbors came out and started re-roofing each other's houses, you know? So we're always going to have...
That's the individual paradigm-changing stuff that I'm referring to. See, that's where it's going to work, is on that individual level. But on the big systemic level, I think it's almost impossible to try to find a solution from within. It's like, and this sounds, I don't know what it sounds like. Maybe it sounds radical.
You and I, Freemasonry, Fredo, you know, it can't be fixed from the inside.
Well, now that's a different animal slightly, because we're entering into a more, it's okay.
Can
so
I make an
I'm,
observation?
Sure.
The reason why everybody suddenly came out of all their homes and started helping each other is because it was really obvious that they'd all just been really, really hit hard, and all of them felt like they wished someone would help them. And so what they do is they help the person next door, and there's a flow-on effect because shared experience produces a shared result. So the key to waking people up, like it or lump it, is fracking trauma. You have to traumatize people.
Unfortunately.
Bring them back to some sort of zero point where they can perceive reality not obstructed by all these false constructs that form up around us with our, you know, everyday lives. We create these prejudices and these bigoted false constructs that create walls between us and reality. What happened, Vinny? All of a sudden, everybody had a level playing field because they all had everything wiped out at once. Now, like you said, the universal law of righteousness kicks in. And what is that? You know, go out there and love your neighbor as yourself, man. Help your neighbor. Help your neighbor as yourself. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, that's pragmatic.
Mm. Well, you see this happening all over the place, even in the Christchurch earthquake, for example. Exactly the same story. Somebody didn't know their neighbors, suddenly got involved.
But that back to the point we were making, though, what we're talking about, and I want to address what Jay said about the Freemasonic order. The difference that I would make there is that I wasn't born into Freemasonry. I chose to join it and interact with it. I was born into society. I was born into the culture in which I live in. Now, with Freemasonry, I think that there is a way to change merely by being a presence within the room, within the lodge room. Because if we can maintain a presence in the room, we're there to address the issues as we see fit with our discretion, following our own heart, following our own intuition. We don't see, I had this discussion with Bob Tuscan once, and he's like, why do you still a member of Freemasonry? Why do you still belong when you know that some people do really weird stuff in the name of Freemasons? And I said, well, Bob, in that, you know, should I just leave because of some bad apples or some, you know, there's a few that are bad, so forget about the rest of them and forget about the good guys. You know, don't be there to help anybody else. I don't think so. I think that in the end, I want to be there for those who do understand, for the esoteric Masons who are there. And maybe one day there'll be enough of us to shift the tide in favor of education and in favor of bringing the order back online to what I think it was intended for.
Well, you're
which
talking
is to help
about
individuals.
You're talking about infiltrating a secret society. James, in your opinion, how easy or difficult might that be?
It depends on the order. Some of them you can't join without being invited.
Well, yeah, true, but I'm, you know, like I stand firmly behind my belief that it must be changed from the outside. Now, however, there's a big push going on in Europe right now to basically overhaul, renovate it, and wipe out the old guard, come back in with a fresh new slate, and admit women, do away with all the secrecy, you know, make it a truly Socratic, philosophic order, and sort of reconstitute those Templar tenets. But that's the easy part. The hard part is, of course, going to be fighting them, the Scottish Rite, I should be specific. So, because they think they own it all, you know.
Well, so, and again, yeah. It comes down to that sense of entitlement. And here's the interesting thing. Everything in society that I look at is a direct opposite for what I originally was told that it was. Okay? The wealthy people are the ones who provide all the opportunities. Well, actually, it's the people who are broke-ass mofos who invent something and then create opportunities that create the opportunities. The wealthy are simply like scum on the top of a pond that that stops the light from getting through and kills all the life beneath it. And I'm not going to like bag and put them in there as kind of like, oh, they're all evil people or whatever, but there's an element of that. And I believe it's actually a relatively small element, but just like the tip of a spear, that's not the only dangerous part of the weapon.
Does it matter how big of a spear or how small? Because the tip of it is so laced with the most vile and disgusting poison imaginable that it doesn't matter. I mean, when I came back through Texas, the things I learned were... it takes a lot to shock me, and some of these things did shock me. So,
such
you know, like my sister being accosted around midnight on her front doorstep by some guy identifying himself from the Dallas Scottish Rite, asking a bunch of questions about me, where was I headed, when was the last time we talked, tried to sow the seeds of some rumor, you know, about me and all that, and she basically told him to F off, and she hasn't seen from anyone like that again. But, you know, this happened 2 weeks prior to my passing through Dallas and having lunch with her and her telling me, and, you know, she claimed she was trying to spare my emotions and didn't want to sour my mood and all that. And like I explained to her, I said, well, I have to know these things, you know, to be able to deal with them properly. And so right there from the restaurant we were at, I dialed the special agent at the FBI in charge of my case and had her repeat everything she had just said to me. So, I spoke with that same special agent just yesterday, and like he said, you know, they're having a really difficult time narrowing down a suspect list as to, you know, who it is exactly that's pushing so hard to harass me and to keep tabs on me, because yeah, it could be the Scottish Rite, but it could be the Grand Lodge of Texas. Body to those. So those are questions I'm afraid impossible to answer right now. So, but it is very real.
And Colston, we can hear you, so you're going to mute your microphone there unless you'd like to say something.
Yeah, I was just sitting in the Skype.
Yeah, sorry.
Like it was like some 33rd degree Freemason kind of rapist pedophile just invaded the chat room. Like,
actually, Jay, I remember an interview you gave. I'm not sure who was interviewing you, but I heard that entire story about you being accosted as well. It's very frightening.
It is. I mean, okay, when I moved to Minnesota, I did it, shall we say, the mainstream proper way. I put through a change of address after the fact and so forth. But the point is there was a four-day time frame from the moment I left Texas to the moment I was unpacking in Minnesota when they found me. And found my address, sent me those Masonic charges, which have now become infamous. And how they got that address, we still don't know. The FBI looked into it. There's no way to know how that. It's an impossibility, but yet they got it. So this time, when I moved, I gave a false trail. I have my mail going to a address I'm not at, in a city I'm not at, and I have not left anything on paper, and only maybe, I guess, my bank and the people I deal with at the FBI know my new and correct address, and that's it. And so far, so good.
Well, and also there's the other element as well. How much infiltration do secret society, well, more to the point, how much penetration do secret societies have with the authorities?
It lots comes around here. We have a lot of law enforcement involved in the lodges. I mean, you have whole lodges that are law enforcement lodges where they have like weapons racks where the guys like stow their guns when they come into the lodge room.
For example, we had a lodge called East Dallas Lodge, and that was strictly for Dallas police. Yes.
So you got a huge amount there, and then of course in the court system and judicial system, lawyers and judges and bankers. I mean, I've said it before. The lodge that I first joined when I was going through the degrees, well, actually after I'd gone through the degrees and I had joined the line, I think I was senior deacon then, and we would practice our ritual work at one of the banks in the Lawrence that I lived in. The master of the lodge was the vice president of the biggest bank in town. So on Sundays, we'd go to the boardroom in the bank at the administrative branch and, do the ritual practice work there. And there would be, lawyers and cops. And this local area here where I used to belong to the local lodge here, I demitted. There was 30% of the local police station were members of the lodge. So, and there was only 4 police officers on duty at a time. So it was like, it worked out to where there was like a 30% chance on any given shift, there'd be a lodge brother on call, like on duty in the police station. And it was always strange because I would outrank brothers in the lodge and they'd be police officers in town, and they know my background. It's a small town, right? And so I come back with this high-ranking, a Templar, Grand Representative, and all this stuff, and all this knowledge. And these guys would just be flummoxed, flabbergasted by me, really, because I come up to them and start talking to them as a superior brother in the lodge, and they're like, officers on the police force.
Hey, bro, you should wear a hat with a Freemasonic checker around it.
Totally. No, I have pins. I wear pins all the time. I always have strange, like skull and bones. It looks like the Gestapo SS, and I'm like wearing it on my hat,
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Dude, I was watching The Walking Dead last night, right? It might have been the night before. The kid has a T-shirt on. It has the bear paw, the Blackwater logo, and one of the dudes is riding a Harley that has the SS logo on it.
Yep. I think we've pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, we've put the cork in the bottle on this as far as the symbolism in pop culture. It's clear to me anyway that what was clear a long time ago, like the SRI Institute that did the report in 1970, which was presented to the government, the work that Jay has revealed in the material from the former sovereign Grand Inspector.
Henry
Clausen. Grand Commander. Yeah, Clausen's work called Your Amazing Mystic Powers. These materials make it clear that they knew that Masonic imagery, iconography, Egyptian imagery, and symbolism would have an effect on us. I mean, with that, as a culture, as a society of humans.
Not
here,
just that, the Scottish Rite was funding and participating in that research. Yes.
Yeah, they were working with intelligence agencies who had already admitted in the 70s, there was, I think it was the Tower or the Church Commission in America, during the time when Bush was either right before or right after he was the head of the CIA, the first Bush president was the head of the CIA before he was vice president. And during that time, it was they admitted openly to the world, to the government, to people of America, that they were conducting mind control experiments called MK Ultra and the Project Artichoke, and so we know they were doing it. And then you combine it with the claims made by Clausen in that work, and the material and the report given by the SRI Institute. All these things connect the dots together, and you get a clear picture of them utilizing movies, television, music. I'm reading a book right now, guys, called The Wrecking Crew. Have you ever heard of that book? Probably not. It just came out recently. This book is The Wrecking Crew. I don't know if you've ever heard of the term, but it turns out in America, in L.A. radio, rock and roll scene, the record producing industry in L.A., there was a wrecking crew of 10 to 15 artists who did all the music on every pop 45 hit that I ever grew up with between the 60s and the 70s. All the great songs of America were all done by the same 10 or 15 guys who got absolutely no credit for it. And they're called the Wrecking Crew. They were studio mercenaries that were brought in to do the work perfect. Because think about it, guys. Studio work is expensive work. I mean, you know, I have some friends. You know, the band Systemic, who does the music for my show. These guys have been working on one song for a year and a half. Just one song. I mean, they are perfect. They're like Steely Dan over there. They're perfectionists. They got to get it right. Now, if every rock and roll band did that every time they made an album, they would kill the record, the producers, the record companies, everybody. They could never sustain that. I mean, Axl Rose, but for the last 10 years, Axl Rose, aside from collecting about $5,000 a week for the royalties of Appetite for Destruction from the Guns N' Roses and all those albums, he spent $10 million of studio money just working on the Chinese Democracy, that album that I think just now maybe has finally come out. But he used every musician all over the industry to come in, paid them all, and he just milked it, man. 10 years in the studio. It's a musician's dream, really. But the point is if every musician had done that back in the day, they needed a hit every couple months churned out like a record factory. They can't have a high Joe Walsh coming in there and smashing his guitar and not doing any work. They need a mercenary who can come in, not ask any questions, sit down, lay the track down exactly the way they want it, and get the hell out of there and get his paycheck and go home. And that's what they got in these Wrecking Crew guys. So what does it mean to you and me? It means, once again, everything we thought was real is not. It's all a facade. It's all fake. When I hear a song on the radio, Layla, Derek and the Dominoes, you know, Eric Clapton, and that's not them, you know. Like, that track was done by the Wrecking Crew. They just put those guys' name on it after they recorded it. And it's a perfect example of that. It's all designed and contrived to impress upon us a specific idea about things that serves a purpose. It gives us the illusion of the superstar, the genius like Mozart, that we'll all idolize. And it's an unrealistic expectation that no artist could really achieve what's happening here, because they cannot meet that unhuman standard that is provided with a Wrecking Crew type, underground background.
And with that note, it scared the whiz out of me, so I'm going to go take one. But continue the conversation. I'll be right back.
Well, I don't know. Colston, are you there with us, buddy? I'd like to hear your views on that.
I'm here. Yeah, we were discussing this yesterday, I believe, yesterday afternoon. And I find it very perplexing and What's the word? Troubling. Yeah, that's the word. Yeah, I mean, it's like this great music sound machine that was created out of what? For want of ear candy, basically. What the best ear candy they could make.
No, yeah, it was definitely to create, you know, the pop. That what the guys that made up the Wrecking Crew were the guys who would produce that those hits that sold.
I mean, they took the ideas. They took the ideas, and then they, you know, of course, they embellished them a thousandfold, right?
Well, sure. I think it just all comes back to the whole idea of our culture, our society.
Packaged.
Yes.
One big package.
It's industrialized. We need to have every little slice of bacon has to look exactly the same in the package. You know what I'm saying? So
right.
Every 45 has to be, you know, produced, recorded, pressed, and off to the store all within a 2-month cycle. One
no
after
rough
another
edges.
Another.
No, the thing that's that's troubling to me is no rough edges. You know,
no rough edges. Yeah.
No,
well, I mean,
the. No,
that's why bands freaked out and fell away. That's why you end up with situations like we mentioned. There was the band The Grassroots. Vinny, you know that show, The Office, right?
Mm-hmm.
The like Office, very popular show.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with the show.
I'm familiar with the American one and the British one.
Okay, you know Creed, the weird white-haired guy? Creed, who's always saying the weird stuff. He's like an old hippie guy or whatever in The Office. He's like a salesman.
Yeah.
That guy is one of these leftover acid casualties from the 60s. He's the former head lead guitarist and lead singer of the Grassroots, an old pop band in America. You've heard the song. Midnight Obsession, telling all of the world that I love you. Do you know that song?
Nope.
Nope. Well, that's you can hear it on any 60s or 70s classic rock station. It'll come on every hour on the hour.
Dude,
it's
I wasn't even a fetus.
Yeah, right. But around here, we all drank beers to this music. It was our beer drinking, reefer smoking, keg party anthems of the summers of teenage years gone by. The fact of the matter is that this guy was one of those guys that did like the Syd Barrett meltdown on stage because he was an actual musician who didn't want to do this. He was like the Monkees. You know, what do we know about the Monkees, right? What's the big notorious scandal about the Monkees? You know what I'm saying, Vinny?
Vinny, don't feel bad. We're the same age.
Okay. Vinny, the Monkees, you know, that old...
I know, that we're the Monkees and people say
yeah,
we're the Monkee
show,
around,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a big scandal. What was the big scandal, right? Everybody found out they didn't play their own instruments.
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
That
was a big scandal. There was, when I was a kid, we were told back in the 60s they performed at like the Hollywood Bowl, and in the middle of the show, like a Britney Spears show or whatever, the record skipped or something, and everybody realized they weren't playing their own instruments. Well, it wasn't big, it wasn't news to any of the guys in the record industry. That's the way it was. The Monkees had been folk rock musicians on the street scene in LA who got jobs as actors. Now, the problem was, is guys like Mike Nesmith, the guy with the cap of the band, he wore the winter hat all the time. He also, by the way, his family invented liquid paper, Whiteout. That's Mike Nesmith. And he also produced the movie Repo Man with Emilio Estevez, 80s cult classic. But at the time, he didn't like not being able to do his own music either. He thought it was disingenuous. He didn't like it. He fought the record companies and the TV companies for 3 albums. He fought them until they were so big that he said, unless you let us do our own album with our own music, I'm walking right now. And they said, okay, fine, do it. Well, guess what? That album didn't do very well. There wasn't even one hit on it. Big surprise there. I'm sure they sabotaged that because, gosh, the Monkees would have been a pain in the ass if they'd got a hit, right? What they wanted was those guys to shut up and do what they were told. After they didn't get a hit, they signed the contracts and they just did what the record company want, which was they let them come in and record the vocal tracks, and they let their mercenaries, the studio hired guns, the Wrecking Crew, did the perfect tracks every time, which is what they needed to keep the cost down. Now, that was all old news. But when the Grassroots came up, that guy Creed from The Office, he was the lead singer and lead guitarist of the band. And when they tried to do that to him, he was like, wait a second. I don't like this. I am a guitar player. I know how to play my music. I wrote the song. Let me do it. They wouldn't let him do it. And so he got all pissed off, and his way of responding was to act out. He got high and drunk all the time, and eventually he took a hit of acid before a Billy Graham-promoted show in Hollywood, got on stage and pulled a Jim Morrison before Jim Morrison yanked his pants down and wagged his pecker at a bunch of teenage girls. So they fired him, and he disappeared until he showed up on The Office 40 years later. That's crazy, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's crazy, but as far as I know, that's what life it really is. It's just a messed up thing. You can't make the stuff up. You know? It's just...
Shiite Muslim. Holy Shiite Muslim, right?
Oh, for frack's sake. And the amount of Bolshevik we hear coming out of all of these politicians and stuff like this is just... You know, look.
The Bolshevik is staggering, Vinny. Staggering.
Oh, man. It's beyond a joke now. And it keeps piling up. Like this massive kind of sewage pond that doesn't empty, and it's not breaking down, it's not decomposing, it's just a pile of Shiite Muslim that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and smelling worse and worse and worse. When's somebody gonna grab a shovel and hit it over top of the head and just bang, get the hell out of here? And this is something that everybody was ticking about. And this is going back to our original topic about why people would actually have the mentality of wanting to support the New World Order. Because the New World Order are making progress, and the Truth Movement isn't, was the perspective I hear.
Oh, right. But, you know, at the same time, back to the point that the bigger point here about the facade that is put foisted over reality, and we're forced to view it as reality. Look at the former, the most recent election cycle with in America, the selection cycle, as I like to call it. You know, let's talk about that for just a moment more. You got 50% of the American public registered to vote. You got 50% of them actually show up and vote, and then 50% of them select the president. So that's majority rule in democracy in America, huh?
Allegedly, there was an 18% voter turnout this election. So that meant 9%.
Yeah, exactly.
Around about 9%
votes in the president. And then people are cheering in the streets like it's a big victory for democracy. And I'm like laughing at them. Like, are you kidding me? Really, guys?
You know,
seriously?
You've got a country where bloody 9% decide what the frickin' president's going to be, saying, let's go help other people build their democracies. Let's export ours. Are you fucking kidding me?
And, you know, and like the third party candidates show up at the debates and they get arrested. They took the woman, Jill Stein, who's representing the Green Party.
Yeah.
And they chained her to a chair for 8.5 hours.
With 16 guards. Her and her aides, the two little old ladies, with 16 bulletproof vest wearing freaking M4 carbine. But these little old ladies, we're going to show them off. Oh, yeah. We're
going to
make
freedom.
Sure. I'll show you what freedom tastes like. Open your mouth.
We're real freedom fighters. We fight freedom right here in this back room. And then when the debate was over, they take the lady and they dump her off in a convenience store parking lot on the outskirts of town or whatever. You know what I mean? Let her fend for herself. I mean, come on now. Seriously. I have one more thing to say about the election. We have I know it was brought up. I think Douglas Dietrich, excellent guest you had on the Vinnie Eastwood show a couple weeks ago. That guy, I actually ordered both of his DVDs. He's got a DVD special, and I ordered both of them because I was so impressed. And they should be here any day. But some of the facts that he brought up reminded me of something I'd completely forgotten that I learned. See, the thing about me is the thing that helped me to get on the road of truth seeking was I was a real big fan of trivia. And I liked weird facts, you know, like Ripley's Believe It or Not and trivia when I was a kid. I was the best. I mean, as a matter of fact, I was the champion of the Barnstable House of Correction at the age of 17. Nobody could beat me at Trivial Pursuit, right? But the fact of the matter is that this is one of those things that I think leads people to understand that when you get these weird facts that people are like, that seem out of sequence with what their linear thought of the progression of history is. And here's one of those things. The election cycle of 1876, there was a man named Samuel Tilden who actually won the election that year in America. He won not only the popular vote, he had like over 51%, but he had over 20 electoral votes more than his rival at the time, which was General Rutherford B. Hayes, who was in fact a Civil War general. And that was the key behind the aspect of the first in what we can call presidential selections in America occurred in that election, the one of 1876. Anybody listening who wants to check that out, you can Wikipedia that is there. It's all known information, and it'll lead you to the source material so that you can then verify what's being claimed in Wikipedia. Don't just go on Wikipedia. But the fact of the matter is that Wikipedia is a good gateway to the source material. And the fact of the matter on this story is that that's the beginning of how it's been for over 100 years in America. The big moneyed interests of the day are the ones who select the president, you know, and it's that same facade that we're dealing with. But I'm sorry I took so long. Jay, let's hear what you have to say about all this last ranting we went into here.
But before you do, I'm so sick of talking about the election. I wish we could just fucking move on.
Let's move off the election. Yeah, I don't want to have to talk about the election.
I'm sorry, James. Go.
I'll bridge the gap. When it was all leading up to it, you know, and this hurricane hits, my very first thought was, you know, because some of the work I do at the EU is political strategizing and advising and all that kind of stuff, and it occurred to me, you know, if I was either one of them, doesn't matter who, pick Romney, Obama, it doesn't matter, if I was running for office and that hurricane hit the way it did, I would be down there in the scummiest clothes I own, up to my elbows in sludge, cleaning oil off baby ducks or whatever. But the fact that they even went on and campaigned and just disregarded people suffering all for a bunch of numbers is about as low as you can go in politics, in my mind. And had one of them done that, let's say Romney did it and went down there and applied a little elbow grease to the situation, he would have won by a landslide. Because it just would have changed everything, and that goes to show how stupid these politicians are and how snotty and better than everyone they think they are. You know, it's perfectly okay for him to get dirty at a $30,000 plate dinner, but hurricane hits and there's a little bit of rubbish to clean up off the street. Oh, no. No, no, no. You know, and that's who we want leading our country, someone who's afraid to or fingernails dirty? I mean, come on. Give me a break.
Well, Jay, for a counterpoint, if I could step in for a second, is that at least the president did visit New Jersey, and I actually read in an article in Rolling Stone this afternoon, the latest edition, is that Christie welcomed Obama to New Jersey to check out the disaster area and shunned Romney from coming. Said, stay out of New Jersey. The president and I can handle this. So, got to get a little credit. No,
right, right. And yes, credit should be given where credit is due. So,
if not a token response.
Right. Anyway. Yeah. Well, I heard that maybe Joe, To the people that are up there, you probably know worse things than I do being down here and getting my news from CNN, but it seems to me the worst thing I heard was about how they were having to flood out the gas system with water, which basically ruined it. So this is pretty bad. I mean, they've got a lot of reconstruction and everything else ahead of them, and to be playing political punditry right now is just, I think it's a little, damnable.
I think we have to wrap up this because Vinny's got his next show coming on. But, you know, just to say, of course, you make a good point. You can't trust the media where you're at to tell you about anything else in another region. They lie, they lie, they lie. They misrepresent everything. They create fabricated versions. They zoom the camera in real close on something. If you see that footage online, they had a woman in a boat, like trying to make like she was flooded out, and there's like guys all of a sudden walk by, like in boots, you know, and they're only like up to their friggin' four, you know, up to their knees, and she's acting like she's flooded out, and like it's like what the hell? There it is, you know, it's all fake. But there is a lot of the people in Far Rockaway, New York, got hit the worst. I mean, they lost the boardwalks. There's the water came in and met across the city, the harbor and the sea met in the middle of the city, and it was 5 feet of water. So, and like you said, it's all polluted and toxic water. But I'll tell you right now, the last thing I want to say about this, the people from Occupy Wall Street outdid FEMA and Red Cross in bringing relief locally to those folks. They were out there. People were waiting in line 6 to 8 hours to get water and toilet paper. You know, and the people from Occupy were sending folks out to get people immediate help. The FEMA people were taking your name and giving you a number to call when it's all over so you can file a claim with the government. You know, what's that going to do for you right now, right? It's ridiculous. So that's what we're dealing with. But anyways, I want to say that I'm really glad that we had a chance to get together and talk about the most important issues of the day on Dark Occult and Mysticism. I want to also invite everybody to check out Vinny Eastwood's show over at Vinny Eastwood Show. What's the website there, buddy?
It's the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. Eastwood as in Clint Eastwood as in go ahead, make my radio day.
And it's the lighter side of genocide. And always, you can check out my show, The Middle Chamber, on American. Both of our shows are on American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. This week in The Middle Chamber, we have Mater X, my wife, interviewing Rick Simpson. That's from Phoenix Tears, the Rick Simpson oil creator. So it's going to be awesome. And next week after that, it's going to be me with Lamile Duquette. And then Freeman's going to interview Randy Powell, the Vortex mathematician. So please keep checking out. Go to our websites. Mine's middlechamberfx.wordpress.com, and it's thevinnyeastwoodshow.com as well. And everyone have a great, great experience until we next chat.
All right. James, Freda, Colston, thank you all very much for your time.
Thanks, guys. Have a great one.